At noon, the front room became a dining hall, and in the evenings, a place of intimate worship. Prabhupada had kept the room, with its 12-foot square hardwood parquet floor, clean and bare. The solitary coffee table against the wall between the two courtyard windows was the only furniture. Daily, at noon, a dozen men were now taking lunch here with him. The meal was cooked by Keith, who spent the whole morning in the kitchen. At first, Keith had cooked only for the Swami. He had mastered the art of cooking dal, rice, and sabji in the Swami's three-tiered boiler, and usually there had been enough for one or two guests as well. But soon, more guests had begun to gather, and Prabhupada had told Keith to increase the quantity, abandoning the small three-tiered cooker, until he was cooking for a dozen hungry men. The boarders, Raphael and Don, though not so interested in the Swami's talk, would arrive punctually each day for prasadam, usually with a friend or two who had wandered each day, who had wandered into the storefront. Steve would drop by from his job at the welfare office. The Mott Street group would come, and there were others. Steve is the author, Saksha Mott, you probably know. The kitchen was stocked with standard Indian spices, fresh chilies, fresh ginger root, whole cumin seeds, turmeric, and asafoetida. Keith mastered the basic cooking techniques and passed them on to Chuck, who became his assistant. Some of the other boys would stand at the doorway of the narrow kitchenette to watch Keith as one thick pancake-like chapati after another blew up like an inflated football over the open flame and then took its place in the steaming stack. While the fine basmati rice boiled to a moist, fluffy white finish and the sabji simmered, the noon cooking would climax with the chaunce. Keith prepared the chaunce exactly as Swamiji had shown him. Over the flame, he set a small metal cup, half filled with clarified butter, and then put in cumin seeds. When the cumin seeds turned almost black, he added chilies, and as the chilies blackened, a choking smoke began to pour from the cup. Now the chaunce was ready. With his cook's tongs, Keith lifted the cup, its boiling, crackling mixture fuming like a sorcerer's kettle, and brought it to the edge of the pot of boiling dal. He opened the tight cover slightly, dumped the boiling chaunce into the dal with a flick of his wrist, and immediately replaced the lid. Pow! The meeting of the chaunce and dal created an explosion, which was then greeted by cheers from the doorway, signifying that the cooking was now complete. This final operation was so volatile that it once blew the top off the top of the pot to the ceiling with a loud smash, causing minor burns to Keith's hands. Some of the neighbors complained of acrid penetrating fumes, but the devotees loved it. When the lunch was ready, Swamiji would wash his hands and mouth in the bathroom and come out into the front room, his soft pink-bottomed feet always bare, his saffron dhoti reaching down to his ankles. He would stand by the coffee table, which held the picture of Lord Chaitanya and his associates, while his own associates stood around him against the walls. Keith would bring in a big tray of chapatis, stacked by the dozens, and place it on the floor before the altar table along with pots of rice, dal, and sabji. Swamiji would then recite a Bengali prayer for offering food to the Lord, and all present would follow him by bowing down, knees and head to the floor, and approximating the Bengali prayer one word at a time. While the steam and mixed aromas drifted up like an offering of incense before the picture of Lord Chaitanya, the Swami's followers bowed their heads to the wooden floor and mumbled the prayer. Prabhupada then sat with his friends, eating the same prasadam as they, with the addition of a banana and a metal bowl full of hot milk. He would slice the banana by pushing it downward against the edge of the bowl, letting the slices fall into the hot milk. Prabhupada's open decree that everyone should eat as much prasadam as possible created a humorous mood and a family feeling. No one was allowed simply to sit, picking at his food, nibbling politely. They ate with the gusto Swamiji almost insisted upon. If he saw someone not eating heartily, he would call the person's name and smilingly protest, "Why are you not eating? Take prasadam." And he would laugh. "When I was coming to your country on the boat," he said, "I thought, how will the Americans ever eat this food?" And as the boys pushed their plates forward for more, Keith would serve seconds, more rice, dal, chapatis, and subjects. After all, it was spiritual. You were supposed to eat a lot. It would purify you. It would free you from Maya. Besides, it was good, delicious, spicy. This was better than American food. It was like chanting. It was far out. You got high from eating this food. They ate with the right hand, Indian style. Keith and Howard had already learned this and had even tasted similar dishes, but as they told the Swami in a room full of believers, the food in India had never been this good. One boy, Stanley, was quite young, and Prabhupada, almost like a doting father, watched over him as he ate. Stanley's mother had personally met Prabhupada and said that only if he took personal care of her son would she allow him to live in the monastery. Prabhupada complied. He diligently encouraged the boy until Stanley gradually took on a voracious appetite and began consuming 10 chapatis at a sitting, and would have taken more had Swamiji not told him to stop. But aside from Swamiji's limiting Stanley to 10 chapatis, the word was always, more, take more. When Prabhupada was finished, he would rise and leave the room. Keith would catch a couple of volunteers to help him clean, and the others would leave. Occasionally on a Sunday, Prabhupada himself would cook a feast with special Indian dishes. Steve, Swamiji personally cooked the prasadam and then served it to us upstairs in his front room. We all sat in rows, and I remember him walking up and down in between the rows of boys, passing before us with his bare feet and serving us with a spoon from different pots. He would ask, what did we want? Did we want more of this? And he would serve us with pleasure. These dishes were not ordinary, but sweets and savories like sweet rice and kachoris with special tastes. Even after we had all taken a full plate, he would come back and ask us to take more. Once he came up to me and asked what I would like more of. Would I like some more sweet rice? In my early misconception of spiritual life, I thought I should deny myself what I liked best, so I asked for some more plain rice. But even that plain rice was fancy yellow rice with fried cheese balls. From the very beginning, Prabhupada was cooking and giving prasadam to everyone, not only there, but Sally Agarwal's, and anytime he could, he always cooked and made really delicious prasadam and served it to as many people. Even when he was just having a lecture, there was a few people there, he would just cut up a slice, an apple, into slices and pass out little slices of apple. But when he recognized taking away, and the Americans, every conditioned soul is used to sense gratification. That's what we want. We want sense gratification. But you're taking that all away. You're taking all the sense gratification away. And the only legitimate spiritual sense gratification is prasadam. So he knew how important it would be for everyone, especially Americans and Westerners, how important it would be for them to have really, really delicious prasadam, and a lot of sugar and butter and everything. But nowadays the trend is not so much butter, not so much sugar, and a lot of devotees are older now and can't eat like we did when we were, 20 years old. But still, the principle is, rich, delicious, delicious prasadam. And of course, it's offered to Krishna, and that's the key. The devotees who had been to India, they said they had had dishes like that, but they never tasted like Prabhupada's cooking. And Prabhupada's cooking was special. First, he's a pure devotee and he's offering it to Krishna. And it's prasadam, it's mixed with Krishna's saliva, and it becomes delicious, even more delicious. So, and that's still the principle today. The principle is delicious prasadam. Everyone needs it. There's that famous story, I think it was here in Boston, in the old temple. Prabhupada was there with some of the big leaders in the movement, big time leaders in 69 or something, 70, whenever it was early. But he had some of the biggest devotees with him, and he went around the room. He said, how do do come to Krishna consciousness and say, this is the prasadam, Prabhupada, and everybody says, it's the prasadam, it's the prasadam, it's the prasadam. And Prabhupada said, it said something like, yes, you have all come because of the prasadam. So it's definitely a crucial part of, one of the most crucial parts of our Krishna conscious life. There's so many stories in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Chaitanya would go around and personally serve prasadam, and he would give them more and more sweet rice and everything, and he'd say, fill them up to their necks. Of course, then there's all the things in Prabhupada's purport with, like, just eat enough to keep body and soul together. I don't know what, and that's not very much, just keeping body and soul together. But it's a, you know, when you get more, advanced, you can, you know, devotees tend to generally eat less and eat not so opulent. But I mean, all the associates of Lord Chaitanya were, you know, they're pure devotees, and anyway. So prasadam is important. Prasadam for us, and prasadam for the guests, and prasadam for outside prasadam distribution, like Rath Yatra and Harinam. It's really good to distribute prasadam. There was one snowstorm here in 1978. We had 4 feet of snow in one night. I mean, literally 4 feet of snow. And the whole city was shut down, and nobody could drive on the streets for like a week except for police and fire trucks and ambulances. And the roads were, everybody's walking all over the road. And Niranjana Swami was the temple president. He took us out to, we went out to Boylston Street across from the public library. And we brought a table and had a big pot of khichdi and a couple other things, maybe some chapatis or puris, and distributing prasadam out there. Everybody loved it. It was great. It was great preaching. It's like food for life. But there was one time we did a table out at the Boston Commons at Park Street Station, a real busy area. And we brought the table out. We brought a candy stove with a portable candy stove with a big wok, and they were cooking cauliflower. The head cook was there, and I think he had a chef's hat on and a white apron, and he was real big and impressive looking. And he was cooking cauliflower pakoras on the spot, right there. So they were coming out hot, and they had tomato chutney. So tomato chutney and cauliflower pakoras is nothing better. And they were distributing them to everybody. People loved it. It's great. And we're doing Harinam at the same time. Okay, so this is the Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 8, verse number 11. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 8, verse number 11. Tikritana sanga asana shayanatana snana sanadishu sahamrika jahuna snehanu badha ritaya asit. Let's read it one more time and then do the word. Tikritana sanga asana shayanatana snana sanada sanadishu saha mriga chaguna snehanu badha hridaya asik. Okay, word by word. Iti, thus, kripta anusanga, having developed attachment, Asana, asana,
asana.
Sitting,
sitting.
Shayana,
shayana.
Lying down,
lying down.
Atana,
atana.
Walking,
walking.
Snana,
snana.
Bathing,
bathing.
Asana adishu,
asana adishu.
While eating and so on. Sahamriga jahuna, with the deer calf. Sneha anubandha, captivated by affection. Vedaya, his heart. Asit, became. Translation: due to attachment for the deer, Maharaj Bharata lay down with it, walked about with it, bathed with it, and even ate with it. Thus his heart became bound to the deer in affection. Please repeat. Due to attachment for the deer.
Due to attachment for the deer.
Maharaj Bharata lay down with it.
Maharaj Bharata lay down with it.
Walked about with it.
Walked about with it.
Bathed with it.
Bathed with it.
And even ate with it.
And ate with it.
Thus his heart became bound. To the deer in affection. So I'll read the next verse and I'll purport on that verse. Kusha kusuma samit pala shapala mula kakani ahara ishimano viksha sala rikadi bhyo vayam asham samano tida saha harina kunakena anam samavishakti. Translation: when Maharaj Bharata wanted to enter the forest to collect kusha grass, flowers, wood, leaves, fruits, roots, and water, he would fear that dogs, jackals, tigers, and other ferocious animals might kill the deer. He would therefore always take the deer with him when entering the forest. Prabhupada's purport: how Maharaj Bharata increases affection for the deer is described herein. Even such an exalted personality as Bharata Maharaj, who had attained loving affection for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, fell down from his position due to his affection for some animal. Consequently, as will be seen, he had to accept the body of a deer in his next life. Since this was the case of Bharata Maharaj, what can we say of those who are not advanced in spiritual life, but who become attached to cats and dogs? Due to their affection for their cats and dogs, they have to take the same bodily form in the next life, unless they clearly increase their affection and love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unless we increase our faith in the Supreme Lord, we shall be attracted to many other things. That is the cause of our material bondage. Om again to Mirandasya, Kananjana, Shalakaya, Chakshu, Unmulitam, Nina, Tasmai, Shivarame, Maha. So this is the... Everyone has pure love of Krishna in the spiritual world, every jiva soul. After all, we come from the spiritual world, and in our eternal position as pure devotees of Krishna, then become envious due to misuse of minute independence, and we fall, we come to this material world, though we're sent to this material world. Because you can't stay in the spiritual world if you're with a bad attitude. You can't stay there. The one time Lord Chaitanya was having kirtan at Srinivas Thakur's house, and he knew that there was an impure person in the house. And I forget exactly what happened, but he knew it. I think he stopped the kirtan, had the guy kicked out or something, but his attitude was wrong, so he didn't fit in with the pure devotees. So that's a lesson for all of us. If we're living in the society of great souls, of great devotees, so we have to be careful that our mentality is nice. We have to be nice. There's that one time Prabhupada said, somebody asked him how you know someone's a pure devotee, And Prabhupada said, he'll be a perfect gentleman or a perfect lady. The gentleman, you know, gentleman doesn't just mean that you open the door for an old person or a lady when they come. Or it doesn't just mean that you have, you know, good table manners, you use the right fork or the right spoon. A gentleman means, it means you're a devotee, first of all. And it means not only a devotee, but you behave in a very pleasing, nice way, and you make an effort. Of course, we have so much practice at not being very nice, at having so many births in this world where you're trained, especially in Kali Yuga, you're like practically trained not to be nice. Many kids are trained not to be nice, but specifically by their parents. The parents are like, this is a tough world, you have to get them before they get you, and you have to, you know, look out for not. We're trained not to be gentlemen and ladies. We're trained to be like not nice. So for us, it's a struggle to become gentlemen and ladies. But it's very important for the practice of Krishna consciousness, especially living in the temple, where everyone is a devotee. When guests come, the guests are devotees, and we have to take care of them in a gentlemanly and ladylike way, in the way of pure devotional service. And it is very, very important for us to stay. We have to. It is a qualification for living in the society of devotee. You have to behave like a devotee. So, So in the spiritual world, we have bad attitude. We have to come to this material world to try to be the Lord and try to be the controller, try to be the independent enjoyer. It doesn't work, but it never works. But the illusory energy, Maya, makes us think that it can work, even though it doesn't work. And we try again and again and again, it never works. Or it works for a little while, and then it doesn't work anymore, and things inevitably go wrong. But still, Maya makes us think that it can work. Maya makes us think it can work. It's a very powerful illusion. Maya is a very powerful illusionist. Even though nothing ever works out the way we want it to work out, she makes us think that, but it can work out. This next time it'll work out. That's how powerful Maya is. Such a powerful illusionist. We're always fooled. Like every time we're fooled again and again and again. Like a real young kid, you can fool them time and time and time again with the same stupid little trick you do. Of course, when they start to get older, like 4 or 5 or 6, they start to figure it out. And they start to figure out, you're lying to me. You're not. They start to figure it out. But we're like little kids, and we never figure it out. And sometimes people do figure it out a little bit, and that's called bhogatya. You want to enjoy, and then you get tired of trying to enjoy because it never works. That's bhoga. And then you say, well, I'm just going to renounce it. Nothing is working. I'm going to live without. I'm going to live by. I'm going to be a hermit in the woods. I'm going to no more women, no more men, or no more this, or no more that. And you renounce. That's piyad. And after a while, you get tired of that, and you're overpowered by your senses and your material desires again. and you go back to trying to enjoy. It's a seesaw. Sometimes you're in the state of bhoga, and sometimes you're in the mentality of tyaga. So anyway, the Maya is so powerful that we're always in illusion. But to come out of that illusion is the process of Krishna consciousness. We hear from Prabhupada, we hear from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, we hear from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Like the purport yesterday was material comforts cannot be increased or decreased. It is therefore said in Srimad Bhagavatam, Talabhite Dukavat Anyata Sukham. As far as material happiness is concerned, that comes without effort, just as tribulations come without effort. Material happiness and pain can be attained without endeavor. One should not bother for material activities if one is at all sympathetic or able to. Anyway, so that's like a materialist considers that to be a very strange statement. Like just, what are you talking about? You can't increase your sense enjoyment, you can't increase your pleasure, you're due a certain amount of this and a certain amount of pain, and no matter what you do, people will say, well, what if you win the lottery and you win millions of dollars? Certainly your pleasure will be increased. Now, yes, your sense gratification will be increased, but your pleasure won't be increased, and your pain won't be decreased. You'll still have so much anxiety, so much physical pain, and you'll still have the same amount of happiness, the same amount of distress, and birth, death, old age, and disease are always there. So many of these statements in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, are completely anathema to the materialist way of thinking. You can't increase your sense enjoyment. Krishna says you have a right to your activities, but you don't have a right to the fruits of your activities. That sounds crazy to the materialist. I can work all I want, but I don't have the right to the money. That doesn't sound right. I don't like that at all. So this is so revolutionary. But this is the only way for us to cut us out of the illusion. So that verse says the spiritual master cuts open the eyes with the shalaka is a cutting instrument, and it is a cutting open of our eyes so that we can see the truth. And Krishna says, just try to learn the truth by approaching a bona fide spiritual master, inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. Spirit, self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. If I've been to Hawaii and you haven't, and I come back and tell you what it's like, and I can tell you all about it because I've seen it. And you can have faith in my words if you trust me. You can have faith in my words if you think I'm not crazy. So a pure devotee, someone who's had his eyes open, or is a pure devotee coming from the spiritual world, they can cut open our eyes and give us a spiritual understanding, spiritual knowledge. So in this case, anyway, Bharata Maharaj, he got attached to the deer. He was a great soul, he was a great devotee. He got attached to the deer, and it's not like he basically gave up his devotional service. But even though he gave up his devotional service, he didn't forget Krishna. And Krishna certainly didn't forget him. Even if we become rascals, even if we act like try to act in a material way and go for sense gratification again, Krishna never forgets us. So there's that incident with Prabhupada, who said, my spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he never forgot anyone who did even a little service for him. And he always appreciated, never forgot. And one of Prabhupada's disciples said, Prabhupada, you're like that too. You never forget anybody who does some devotional service. And Prabhupada's reply was, and he cried, and he said, there were tears, and he said, how can I forget? You're all helping me execute the order of my Guru Maharaj. So Prabhupada's service to his own spiritual master is so important to him, to life and soul, that anyone who helps him do that is dear to him. I was listening in the kitchen yesterday, Prabhupada was talking, and somebody was walking on the beach in India, in Juhu, with some of the Indian men that were always challenging them and raising objections. And one of them was saying something negative about the Americans, and Prabhupada said, he said, no, I always appreciated the Americans. They helped me. They always helped me so much. They never put any hindrance in my way. The government, like in this country, the government isn't great, but basically you can do what you want. The government generally won't bother you. If you want to go out on the street and chant Hare Krishna, you can go. And you can do what you want. So Prabhupada, he appreciated the American government. He appreciated the American people. That's just an example. So the thing is that Prabhupada appreciated anyone who helped him with a little bit of devotional service. So if the pure devotee doesn't forget us, then Krishna will never forget us. Anyone who is claimed and is dear to the pure devotee will be accepted and be dear to Krishna also. That is a guaranteed fact. So Bharata Maharshi forgot. He forgot his devotional practices, but nobody could take away. It's like in the morning he wake up and he see his little deer and he starts thinking about his deer. But it's not possible that he could have completely forgotten about Krishna just because he was fixated on his deer. And it's not possible that Krishna would forget him. And the fact of the matter is, the proof of that is that in his next life, which is given by Krishna specifically, he gave him the body of a deer. But that deer, in the body of a deer, he was attracted to saintly persons, and he would live near and go to the ashram and the association of saintly persons. And because he remembered, or he was naturally attracted, at least. And in his next life, as Jad Bharat, as we'll see, Krishna gave him the body of a human being, but he determined from birth, he was a great, he remembered his devotional service and that the problem had been in his previous life from birth, and how he had to take the body of a deer, and he determined within himself that I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to make the same mistake again. So I'm just going to be quiet. I'm not going to talk to anybody. I'm going to let them think that I'm an idiot. I'm going to behave like an idiot. And his father would try to teach him how to do things, and he wouldn't learn. He would refuse to learn. And his father, even the simplest thing, his father would try to teach him how to do, and he just wouldn't learn. And his father didn't know that, oh, he's pretending. His father just thought, well, he's a moron. He can't learn. He's retarded. He'll never learn anything. So they treated him like that. They neglected him. And when his father died, his brothers and sisters, They mistreated him. They hardly gave him anything to eat. They gave him like garbage to eat and burnt rice and stuff. And they put him out in the field to act as a scarecrow, which is pretty bad. You stand out here. You're the scarecrow. So that's what they thought of him. They weren't very nice brothers and sisters. But he didn't care. Anyway, that's the whole chapter is coming up. But the point is that he didn't forget Krishna, and Krishna didn't forget him. He had to take a temporary detour from his really quick progress back to home, back to Godhead. But it was only two lives, which is a short period of time, considering the length of time we've been in the material world. So Krishna never forgets the devotee, and if somebody has some difficulty, Krishna makes all kinds of arrangements for them to learn lessons. A lot of times you have to learn lessons in devotional service that are very hard to learn. Krishna is not always gentle. Oftentimes he's like persuasive and gentle, but he's not always gentle in the way he teaches his lessons. Sometimes he teaches us lessons in a very, very hard way. But we need it, because we're stubborn and we refuse to learn. Oftentimes we refuse to learn in an easy, nice way. So sometimes the lessons are very difficult, but that's temporary also. You learn whatever you have to learn, you pass through that phase. And of course there are many other things that we have to learn after that, but they're all temporary, and gradually we become more and more purified. And they become so nice that we don't need difficult corrections anymore, but we're just very eager to improve our behavior, improve our mentality, and just because our spiritual master likes it, and because Prabhupada likes it, because Krishna likes it, so we just want to improve. So I'll stop there. Any questions or comments? Yes.
I have a question. Because when we reflect, we may understand, but we cannot increase our happiness. Yes.
We cannot
increase our material happiness.
Yeah.
We can increase our material enjoyment, but not happiness. Yes. But still, we all make some plans. Like, what is the basis for, say, in India, parents? They try to find the best match, like when they marry, like their daughter, like.
Yeah.
This match means like they think, okay, this match my daughter will be happy, and she will not be happy.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have that high position,
right.
He doesn't have a good salary. But like based on Bhagavad Gita said that she will get the same amount of happiness.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter, but because we don't have full faith, that's why, or like we are choosing a job, like we try to feel more comfortable. Okay, this job gives me more happiness.
Yeah, but that the amount of happiness you're due is determined already, and naturally, as individuals, as individual persons, we try. It is a fact. It's an inevitable fact that everybody tries to increase their. Find a nicer way to live, a more comfortable way to live. And so the devotees, and that's the whole life for the non-devotee. For the devotee, we do that. I didn't sleep outside last night. I came in the temple to sleep because I didn't want to be out I didn't want to be freezing all night. I wanted to be warm. So that we're going to do is we're going to try to find a nice husband or a nice wife. We're going to take the type of prasadam that pleases us, These things we are going to do, but at least the devotee should, we always, I mean, that's just part of being an individual. Of course, in the spiritual world, the determination for what you do and what you don't do is only to please Krishna. Like Radharani, Chaitanya Charitamrita, this section, she says that, you know, if I see that Krishna is getting more pleasure by associating with some of the other gopis, I want to make arrangements for Krishna to meet the other gopis. And the gopis feel like that about Radharani. They say, they're always trying to make arrangements for Srimati Radharani to meet Krishna. And Radharani says, if what I do pleases Krishna, but it doesn't please me, that will be my greatest happiness. And if something ordinarily would be pleasing to me, but I see it's not pleasing to Krishna, then that thing which is pleasing to me will be my greatest unhappiness or greatest distress. So that's like the really extreme position. That it doesn't, you know, not only doesn't it matter what I want or what, but anyway, we're not on that platform. We're just not.
So we should do some distinction, and we should try to arrange like our life more comfortable. Should we?
Well, we do. We will.
Should we do it?
Yeah, I mean, to say should is like almost beside the point, because we will. And there are certain arrangements that if you're trying to choose a husband or choose a wife, and you have two different people, you're gonna think, well, what about this one? I don't know, I don't like that. What about this one?
But we choose based on, like, she thinks, okay, I like him more, means I will be happier with him.
I know, that's why I'm saying.
Bhagavad was saying, a lot of happiness is already.
Yeah, but our realization isn't very great. So we work with the realization that we have. We have to work from the platform we're on. And like Satsaruma Maharaji said in that book, when Swamiji was serving out prasadam, in his early idea of spiritual life, he thought that he should refuse. He wanted the sweet rice. He still loves sweets, I'll tell you. He still loves sweets. And he wanted the sweet rice, but he said, well, I'll just take the rice.
Explained, it wasn't just plain rice.
Right. I mean, even that was, we have to work from the platform we're on, and it doesn't matter. Prabhupada was happy that he was eating prasadam, and so he didn't take the sweet rice, but he took the regular rice, and even if he's just cutting up an apple and giving a slice of apple, the Prabhupada knew that this is Krishna prasadam, and this will take him back home, back to Godhead. So we have to work with what we've got. So we have to use our bodies to the best of our ability. We have to be active physically using our bodies. We have to use our minds in the best way possible to serve Krishna according to the intelligence we're giving. Somebody like Jayadvaita Swami, or, you know, so many brilliant devotees in the movement, they can use their minds in ways that I can't. Actually, I was really proud of myself that Sunday that Jayadvaita Swami gave the lecture, because he couldn't think of the second line of a Sanskrit verse. And he knew, he got the first, third, and fourth, he couldn't think of the second line, but I knew it. And I gave it to him. So I was like really proud of myself. But that's never happened before, and it'll probably never happen again. Jayadvaita Swami is like brilliant. And so he can use his mind and intelligence in ways that I can't. But I can work with what I have. And we just work with whatever we have. And that's good enough. It's good enough. There's one, this will be my last thing. There was one example of this devotee early, I think it's in Montreal or Toronto. The first temple was one of those cities. And in Canada, the second temple. in the movement. And there was, Prabhupada was visiting there, and there was, so wherever Prabhupada went, a lot of the devotees from hundreds of miles around would go where Prabhupada was. So there's all these big devotees there, and there was one devotee who was cooking in the kitchen, and he would make a lot of chapatis. And he told Prabhupada one day, he said, Prabhupada, all these other disciples, they can do all these things, to please you, the big things, and I can't do much. I don't have that kind of capability. I can't do much. And Prabhupada said, that's very good. You just keep making chapatis in the kitchen, and that will be your perfection. So we work with what we have, and we have a tendency to want to enjoy it. That's inevitable. As long as we're conditioned souls in the material world, we will always think, oh, I like this better than that, so I'm going to try to get this instead of that. We will always think like that. It's inevitable. But the thing for the devotee is to minimize it. We live simply. We try to live simply. We don't have fancy couches everywhere and widescreen television and a closet full of 100 dresses and 50 pairs of shoes, or maybe you do, I don't know. But devotees live simply. We live simply because we know that we're supposed to, we're conditioned souls, and we have a tendency to want and need some sense gratification, but we should keep it to a minimum. And we should keep ourselves focused on Krishna consciousness. Okay, so stop there. Have a blessed day, Shri Prabhupada.